time so we can play among the stars. Come and see what war was like before the coming of Sigmar. In other words, here they are. In other words, that old world charm.
Hello, all you old world enjoyers, or, you know, charming old world denizens, as we could say. This is the Old World Charm podcast. My name is Adam Camilleri. Welcome to episode 7. We're on our way all the way to that magical episode 13, which is apparently, according to all podcast aggregates, the number you need to reach to be a real podcast. So we're not real boys yet, gentlemen. I'm joined by Peter the Falcon. Hello, mate. How you doing?
Hello, lover. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm struggling with a bit of a headache right now, but it's a beautiful day outside. That Melbourne weather, that Melbourne summer is finally starting to kick in the last failing weeks of summer.
So is it Melbourne? Like, do you not pronounce the R or?
Yeah, it's Australia. We pronounce the bare minimum of everything. It's just okay. Melbourne. M-E-L-B-N. Melbourne.
Yeah, because I know like Canberra. You don't bother with the E in Canberra for some reason. At least some of you don't.
K-A-N-B-R-A.
Yeah, pretty much.
Canberra.
I don't know what you do about Victoria. I think you just call it Victoria.
Yeah, Vic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And Perth is just where the idiots live.
Perth is a mining colony. Yes.
It's on Mars. I get it. It's all making sense to me now.
Yeah.
Does Australia have some kind of blood diamond equivalent? Like, is it like a blood opal there?
Probably, you know. Actually, there could be a story about such a thing. Unfortunately, fortunately, we don't have the pseudo slave labor that unfortunately has made that story. It's gravitas, but we do have cashed up Bogans, which could definitely make a very, you know, nice second place, you know, in their way too overcharged, expensive cars hooning around.
Cashed up Bogans.
Bogans. So when I was a young man, there was a mining boom in Australia, like one of the biggest of all time. And I had the choice to pretty much drop everything, move up to, you know, the Western Australia, work for probably 27 days out of a 30-day month, but make a phenomenal amount of money, like general mining. Mm-hmm. And many of my friends did. And those guys are cashed up Bogans.
Cashed up Bogans.
I think that would have been a better name for this podcast, to be honest.
God.
Honestly,
Adam, this is on you.
I feel like that's going to be the rich dwarf person's podcast. Cashed up Bogans. They're miners. They're cashed up. They're pretty rough around the edges. Yeah, I realize we're there already.
When I make my own missions for Old World, one of them is going to be Cashed Up Bogans for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Hello, Danny, the sweetest of meats, has rejoined us from his intrepid interlude last week.
Hey, Adam. Wow. I'm not dying, I promise. I'm not dying anymore, I promise.
No, you have you have a dead man's mouth inside your mouth.
It's true. Yeah, we call him Corpse Mouth now. but also, for those who do not know, joining us for the very first time, we are fully fledged on all aggregates, and our social medias are up and running thanks to various parties within this podcast. We've all taken on different mantles, so to speak. But if you guys do want the part two of this, come and join us over on That Old World Charm over on Patreon. You get the part two here. That will be recorded directly following this. We've got a bunch of listener questions. In addition, Danny's going to a tournament on the weekend. We're going to unpack what he's bringing, what he's going to hoping to see and play into, what he's worried about, what he's not worried about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, any games and spicy lists myself and Peter have been working on.
That's so exciting. Please,
so exciting, mate. So exciting.
How was your Valentine's Day?
We did Valentine's Day the day after Valentine's Day. So we were just like, skip the nonsense. We went out together and we bought some flowers for the house and we just filled a bunch of vases throughout everything and we had a nice dinner together and it was pretty beautiful. What did you do, mate?
It was a little weird because I was working some weird hours this week. Also my partner is allergic to flowers. So I bought flowers for my daughter. And then I bought oysters and I had a fruit bouquet delivered to my partner's office so she could have that. And I guess that was quite the big hit over there because they were having a meeting in this giant fruit basket came in shaped like flowers, and they all ate that. And so I got none of it. And then we just kind of had a quiet, really late evening, because by the time I got home, it was like 11:30 p.m. That day. And then the next day, the kids were away, so we hung out together for the day. Beautiful. Just relaxed. So.
Oh, nice.
Lovely. Danny, how did you go?
I was recovering from surgery, so my son wife made me dinner. Cool. I could eat for the first time in like a week. It was great.
That's incredible.
Did
I totally flipped there, right? Like I went from immediate, like, wow, that is awful, to, oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, it's nice.
Peter, two-faced colossum over
that's
here.
That's me. Oh,
that's right. All right.
Well, it's because I jumped to conclusions immediately. So I hear the first sentence, I'm like, that's it, it's over. And then, oh, never mind.
When you're the most judgmental man on the face of the earth, this is the kind of power that you can accomplish.
It's true. It's true. I don't know if you guys know this. Val told me that I was the most opinionated person he'd ever podcasted with. And he podcasts with Rob Symes. And I like actually cried. I went into my room and sat down for a while.
I was there.
I was like, I cannot deal with this being called out as more opinionated than that man. But you know, such is life.
For those who don't know, that's Rob and Val from Squarebase Podcast. Go over and enjoy some of their content too, because they're doing some fine works. So we have spent the last couple of weeks working our way through how to play a game. We've done 6 episodes on how to pretty much play a game of the old world. And now we're into a space where we can kind of have a bit more fun. We wanted to put out a bunch of content early on that is going to be evergreen and help people get in. We did make some mistakes in there, and we will speak to those possibly where they are relevant, because we, you know, this is a brand new thing, and without playing many games, we are, you know, caused to review things from a certain perspective. So we do get things wrong. So we do apologize for those, and we will be correcting ourselves where possible. But this episode, we now get to, you know, kind of unlimber a bit and jump around. And the issue being, the next thing that comes up in the basic rule book is give or take 100 special rules, which reading out one at a time sounds god-awful for a listening experience. So this episode, we're going to be jumping around a little bit. We're going to read a couple of pages of the USRs. Then we're going to jump and talk about mission structure. And then we're going to jump and review some special spicy magic weapons in this basic rule book. So we've got a bit of a variety for you, but all still reviewing some of this good stuff and giving you a bit of a knowledge dump of various things of how to play the game. Next week, we're going to completely mix things up. We are going to put down this big blue book, and we're going to transition over to and review one of the factions for the old world as voted upon by our patrons. So they will have the opportunity to vote on any faction in the freaking game that they want, legacy, non-legacy, we don't care, renegade, whatever you want to call them. And we will review that on this main show to the best of our ability, from the deepest, most crunchy, getting stuck into the good stuff as we can. And then the part 2 will be writing as many lists as we can, or different archetypes or styles of things and combos. But I mean, I'm excited to mix it up a little bit, have a bit more fun, even though we did our best to make it as uncrunchy as possible. Isn't that right, Jance?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I've never been here before. This is literally my first time being on this show. What is the old world?
is that like a place?
Yeah, I figured it is. You know, like there's Old Town, like, you know, a lot of places have their old town. Yeah, that's the old world. It's essentially, But anyway, for those who jump along and following along at home, because you know everyone has their big blue books, page 165 is where you want to start if you want to follow along. Gentlemen, USRs, special rules. Like, I love that in many other game systems, Games Workshop tried to get away from these, and then we beat them down and made them go back to them over about a six year. It took us 6 years to make them go back to USRs, but now USRs are pretty much in every single game that GW does. But what is a universal special rule, Peter?
These are just like rules that deviate from the core game rules. So they add like a special bonus to all of those things we've described before when it comes to movement or shooting or close combat, or they just have some other effect on the battlefield. There's universal special rules, which are special rules that basically in general every army has access to, or the majority of the armies have access to. There's also army special rules, which are generally army specific. And then unique special rules, which are unit specific.
Spot freaking on. Okay, rules priority. Oh, sorry. What special rules does it have? look at the data sheet, look at the unit entry. That'll tell you the vast majority of special rules it has, and therefore anything, any others that it have will be annotated in its army special rules and or attached by war gear. Those are the kind of the three places you'll end up getting yours. War gear being armor, weapons, talismans, etc. But rule priority, sometimes special rules can seem a bit contradictory. Army special rules take precedence over universal special rules or rules associated with a model's troop type. Unique special rules take precedence over universal special rules, army special rules, or rules associated with a model's troop type. That read like eating glass. But what does that mean to the game, Danny?
Well, it gives you it gives you like what authority is going to be binding for any particular rule. So it's always, so obviously army rules are going to take precedence in situations like where other rules would normally take, because that's how the army is supposed to work, right? So like, obviously those ones are probably going to take precedence over how the main game like operates in any particular way. I was just thinking about unique special rules. I guess those are just like things that are on a unit's data sheet specifically, right?
And yeah, only theirs. Yeah. So like an example of like a unique special rule that trumps other special rules, like Cetra the Imperishable for Tomb Kings, he's got a special rule that says his heavy chariot can actually join light chariots as part of a unit. Right. Whereas like the heavy chariot troop type has a rule that says you could never do that, because Cetra has that rule and it's a unique special rule. It trumps the rest. It would be if, let's say, the Tomb Kings book had an army special rule that also said something like heavy chariots can only join some other form of chariot. Cetra would trump that because it's a unique special rule to Cetra, because he's the king shit. So
yeah.
Well, one thing I was just thinking, like, sometimes the same rule is an army special rule and sometimes it's a unique special rule depending on what army it's in. Mm-hmm. Like Cleaving Blow, for example.
Yeah. Cleaving Blow is this like weird situation where it should have just been a universal special rule, in my opinion, because it's in like 75% of the army books. But I feel like when you read through, I believe they were trying to get 75 because it was a nice round number. And then they were just like, anything else, we're going to toss out and say it's something different.
Fine. We'll just add Warband.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Culminative special rules. Unless otherwise noted, if the effect of a special rule in some way alters a characteristic, the result or of a dice roll or any other value, such as a model's armor save, that effect is culminative. This means that the effects of duplicate versions of the same spell combine together, increasing its effect. For example, if a model under the effect of a spell that granted armor bane 2 carries a weapon that has armor bane 1, that model would be considered to have armor bane 6. So when you roll a 6 to wound, it's neg 3 to the armor save. That is good to know, because unless otherwise stated, I think is culminative more of a permissive thing? Like, you needed to say that it's culminative, or do we assume things are culminative unless said otherwise?
So the way this is written, we're supposed to assume things are cumulative unless they say otherwise. I have actually, because we had some chat in our patron Discord about the frenzy rule, because it fits the markers for these, other than not having a number in brackets. And I feel like the rules writer should have just said any special rule that has a number in brackets is cumulative, otherwise isn't, because it fits a little bit better, because technically right now frenzy does work this way, where you can have multiple instances of frenzy granting you more attacks. That said, I did submit it for an FAQ, and so I'm hoping to hear something back, and maybe we'll get something on that in the future, because it doesn't feel good to have minotaurs with like +8 attacks,
but they're more frenzious.
They're the extra frenzied.
That's what they have to say. You have to say, I'm more frenzied. All right. Well, let's read some universal special rules. Our plan is to read out, you know, about 4 pages of these, so 2 page spreads of these, and then move on, come back to them another time, and kind of work our way through them in a more manageable bite rather than.
Why don't we just cover like like the ones we like the most, or some cool ones from each page if we can. It might be too difficult.
There are some of these that we are going to gloss over. Some of the very, like Armorbane. We do not need to read out Armorbane again. People know what is up with that. But the first is Ambushes, which is a very important ability. A unit with this special rule may be held in reserve rather than being deployed on at the start of the game. From the beginning of round two onwards, roll a d6 during each of your start of turn subphases for each unit in Ambush. In your army that is held in reserve. On a 1-3, the unit is delayed until your next turn. On a 4+, that unit arrives, entering from the battlefield as reinforcements during the compulsory move subphase. This unit may be placed on the edge of any battlefield and chosen by the controlling player, but cannot be placed within 8 of an enemy model. If any ambushes are held in reserve by the start of the round 5, they arrive automatically. There has been a lot of debate between Vanguard, Scout, and Ambush, and I'm of the opinion Ambush is the worst of these possible abilities. I always and forever have hated that it is a 4+. I mean, I know there are ways to increase that ability. I know, especially with Tomb Kings. But gents, how do you feel about ambushes in the old world? Danny?
I think there's a time and a place for ambush. I think you can kind of make it work with Beastmen because you can just Brayhorn every turn. And that's like probably the best use of ambush. And then Tomb Kings have Entomb Beneath the Sands. But see, they get to like mess with the ambush rules, but like baseline ambush by itself is so risky because you never know if you're going to actually be able to roll that 4+ and have the unit come on the table.
It should be scaling in some way. It should go 4-3-2 automatic or something like that. The fact that it's not inconceivable that I roll like 3 times and do not roll a 4+. And so a unit that I would want to use, I paid points for in my freaking army, does not arrive to the battle. Like, because if it runs on, I'm telling you right now, automatically arrives on turn 5 means they do nothing. Like they showed up and they stood there. They did nothing. If they have shooting weapons, congratulations. They hopefully contributed, but that is just the worst turn of events. Is that fair to say, Peter?
Oh yeah. And like, it should be noted, like they don't have, a special rule for if they can't fit on the board, like if there's no way to get within 8 inches of enemy models. Yeah. So if you are screwed and you get stuck till turn 5 and you're up against like some really skirmish heavy army, there's some potential for some real feel bads moments. Depending on how much you're investing into ambushers. They're definitely the worst of the three between Scout, Vanguard and this for kind of extra deployment rules. You know, that said, like Danny said, there are some benefits, particularly with Beastmen and Tomb Kings, where they can manipulate the dice. Maybe if you have a small squad that you really don't care if they don't show up till turn 5, just to act as a harasser, sure. Yeah. But I wouldn't invest heavily into it without some extra guarantees.
Here's something that we didn't talk about, and I don't know how exactly this works, right? I just read the deployment section again. And it doesn't make any like notion of when you're supposed to like have stuff in. It does say held in reserve rather than be deployed. Okay, so that has a specific like connotation to it. Never mind. Okay, I'm gonna stop.
I was
maybe you could make out a deployment with it or something.
The idea, but
the way to make ambushes good is to incentivize it in the mission structure. And right now there is nothing to incentivize it. There is no reason to. We're actually going to talk to that later in the episode. But I think there should be a means to make ambush feel good. And even on these terms and conditions that come on, you know, every turn is a 50-50, which sucks so bad.
Table we've quarters got, would be huge. Like
exactly right. Table quarters or having – we used to have to have fortitude in table quarters in a lot of missions in Australia, and I know in a lot of missions the world over, and that I think would be a big thing to bring back into the game, but we'll talk about that later. Peter, feel free to gloss over Armorbane in as quickly as you like and go straight into Armorhide, mate. Tell us
sure. about that. Sure. Armorbane is a special rule that if your weapon has it, any wound roll to 6 increases the AP of it increases the AP of it by that amount. So if you have Armorbane 3 and you roll a 6 to wound, then your AP goes from, say, a 0 to a -3, which is awesome. Armored Hide, that is basically a rule that increases your armor save based on the Armored Hide number. Dragon Ogres, for example, have Armored Hide 2. So if you give them heavy armor, they go from a 5+ to a 3+, because that Armored Hide increases their defense. Same with any kind of unit that's on some kind of mount. Mm-hmm. If it has the armored hide rule, it does improve their armor save. If it has its own armor save instead, then it does not. You pick the greater of the two. So
easy done. Good rules. I mean, I rate Armor Bane as a relatively good rule, especially to have on baseline infantry to make them, you know, punch up a little bit. But armored hide seems just like playing with what we used to have.
Yeah, often when something has armored hide, like it's what gets you back to the way it used to be.
Yeah.
With like thick skin or, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Danny, take it away with breath weapons. This is actually a little bit to unpack.
Sure. A model with a breath weapon can use it once per round during the shooting phase of its turn. Place the flame template with its broad end over the intended target and the narrow end touching the model's base anywhere along its front arc. The template must lie entirely in the model's vision arc. Any model whose base lies underneath the template risks being hit, as described on page 95. The strength and any special rules of the breath weapon will be detailed on the creature's rules. Breath weapons cannot be used when making a stand and shoot charge reaction or when the model is engaged in combat.
So a lot's changed there. It used to first and foremost, a lot of breath weapons used to be once per game, as far as I remember. Mm-hmm. But they could be used in combat. Could they be used in Overwatch? In stand and shoot? I don't believe they could.
I don't know. They could be used in combat, and they had that. Yeah. In fact, I believe almost all of them were in combat, was what you used them on. But
yeah.
Yeah. I think it was either you use it when you shoot or you use it when you fight, but you can't use it when you stand and shoot. Like it's in the shooting phase or in the fight phase.
How good are breath weapons now, Danny, do you think? Do you rate them as an ability, or is it just like, I'm already taking a dragon? Cool. It's nice to have.
It's okay. So to me, this is a consolation prize for not charging in combat with your dragon.
yep.
Like, so if you're unable to do so and you like, maybe just so he's not doing nothing, like this gives him the option to like maybe do something on a turn when he can't be in combat. It's like a nice to have sometimes, but unless you can like really spam these, like you can have a lot of them on the table and they're on really fast units. Like I'm looking at gyrocopters.
Gyros. Yeah.
Like, I think that they're probably not good. It's nice. Yeah. You can use them all the time now.
Yeah. It is nice. You get more turns out of it because the amount of hits that you're getting has gone down dramatically. I mean, this is showing, I think the diagram they're showing is archers in a 20 block. Four deep, five wide, and it gets five actual hits, like actually five models are hit. But then what? You got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 partials. So on average, you're going to end up with what, 10 total? Because you're going to have 10 four ups. Whereas before, that would have been all of them taking, usually it's around about a strength 4 auto hit. Peter, what do you think about Red Weapons?
Right?
Like, yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think Danny nailed it. It's a consolation prize for the most part. I'm really, really sad that my poor salamanders have breath weapons now and not Column of Fire, because it is really brutal. And you have to work so much harder to get anything out of them. And for most other monsters, like I don't mind paying like 10 points for a breath weapon upgrade actually on some flying monsters, just because there's often going to be that one turn where you're trying to position yourself. Mm. And, you know, killing that one or two extra guys with the breath weapon or more, if you get lucky, it's helpful. So
I also like the idea of I've been charged. I got my breath weapon monster and I charged into something. It didn't actually go my way. I took more wounds than I wanted to. It was a risky play. I've bounced off them going into my turn, and then I don't charge them again. I just flame them and put the damage into them because they're going to be stuck in front of me, and then see if I kill half the unit and if they want to charge back into me and risk a change of metrics possibly having occurred. And I like that idea also. Chariot Runners is the next ability. Friendly models with the troop type that is Chariot can draw line of sight over or through models with this special rule and can move through friendly units of the Chariot Runners that are in skirmish formation. If the Chariot move would result in it ending on top of a Chariot Runner, simply nudge the Chariot Runner aside, blah, blah, blah. You get the idea. Chariot Runner models do not impede chariot units if they're in skirmish formation. Enough said, moving on. Unless there's something else in there I missed, lads.
No, it's a really good rule.
Great rule, actually.
It's awesome. You can screen your chariots, or for lizardmen, your Croxagores with something like this, and they still get to do whatever they want. And they also count, like the chariots count towards the skirmishers' footprint when it comes to their unit coherency, which is helpful as well.
Really cool. Close order, pretty much the special rule here just denotes. So we should have said that. The special rules section, I guess, or the USR section in your unit entry will denote which formation that unit can adopt, be close order, open order, skirmish, lance, etc. So those will come up in this section also. So close order just denotes you can close order. Danny, tell us about counter charge. There is a lot to unpack here, but feel free to TLDR it if you please.
For sure. If your unit has only models with countercharge, you can use countercharge. So if you have one guy that doesn't, like a character, so make sure you really pay attention to what kind of mount you're buying for your character. When a unit with this special rule is charged in its front arc by either a cavalry, chariot, or monster unit, it can instead declare a new type of charge reaction called countercharge. Countercharge can't be used if the distance between the two units is within the movement characteristic of the charging unit. So it's kind of like stand and shoot in that respect. Otherwise, you pivot your countercharging unit about its center so that you're facing directly towards the center of the enemy unit and move D3 plus 1 inches directly towards the enemy unit. And then both units are counted as having charged this turn. You can't countercharge if you're fleeing or you're already engaged in combat. And you can only countercharge against one unit per turn, even if you're charged by multiple units. Once all the charges have been cleared, the inactive player can choose which charging unit to countercharge. The unit will then hold against the other charging units.
Such a cool rule. Is it too good? Is it not good enough? How do you feel about it?
You know, it is a very, very good rule. It's not every single like heavy cavalry unit has this, mm-hmm. but all of the best ones do. So that should speak volumes about like its versatility. It just protects a like otherwise a really fast unit from just getting bombed by another really fast unit. And it makes for mutually assured destruction. And kind of like that whole cinematic scene of the two units charging each other is also really awesome.
Yeah. It's also like the rule I think I see misplayed the most because people forget or miss the fact that it only works against cav, chariots, or monsters.
Yeah, yeah, correct. All right, the next couple of ones can be done pretty quickly. Cumbersome weapons with a special rule cannot be used to make a stand and shoot reaction. Fairly easy to explain. Detachment special rule, all units with this special rule can be fielded as a detachment. Lol. Dragged along and then drilled, Peter. Take it away. Give us both.
Dragged along. It's a rule. If you have it, you generally don't use your own movement. You use the movement of any infantry unit that is within 1 inch of that model. So, for example, the Screaming Bell for Skaven has dragged along. So you would say, okay, I'm using the movement speed of my Storm Vermin beside me, so I move 5 inches instead of the like one that's on my data sheet. It should be noted that unit has to have at least 10 or more models in it, and they cannot be fleeing. So, excuse me. And then drilled. Drilled is like a controversial special rule right now.
Yes, very interesting.
So unless a unit is fleeing, a drilled unit may perform a free redress the ranks maneuver immediately before moving. Once this maneuver is completed, the unit moves as normal. In addition, a drilled unit can march whilst within 8 inches of an enemy unit without first having to make a leadership test. Note that any character that joins a drilled unit is also considered to be drilled. So drilled is very unique in that it does give you this option to go into marching column and out of marching column kind of at will. It's also great for, you know, prepping for a turn where you're expecting to get blitzed by your opponent. The kind of controversy you see a lot of people talk about is, does this work going from marching column into a charge?
Yeah.
Based on the wording of the rule, which is that it's before any movement happens and charge moves are a move, it does feel like you can. This is also a rule that is found in like Warhammer Ancients, which is where it was directly taken from. And that was specifically what it was used for in that rule set. So I imagine it works. I've also had confirmation from some people that, yes, this is how it's supposed to be played. So you can move your triple movement and then on the next turn declare a charge, because the book specifically calls out you can declare a charge when in marching column you just cannot complete your move, a charge move while in it. Then you drilled into your longer ranks and do the rest of your job.
Yeah.
Another big thing here is like not having to make that leadership test for marching, because BSBs no longer give you leadership rerolls on everything. I have found many a time where I have wanted to pull off some great plays that I couldn't because of being march blocked in this edition. So,
yeah, march blocking felt like it was a pointless exercise. Previous editions, everyone was just leadership 9 or 10 rerollable. Their march tests a lot of the time, but now it really feels like it is a barrier to entry. It is an actual impediment you need to try and work around, which I think is a little good, but man, is it frustrating. All right. What is the fix for drilled? I'm of the opinion you could just delete drilled and no one would mind. But also, it is a great freaking rule that is either incredible and possibly busted, or who cares, never heard of it, doesn't matter to me. Does that make it a bad rule in general?
No, I just think we need like an actual factual something on paper that says this is how it works, so that there's no more arguing more than anything. Yeah. Because even if you get off that like drilled maneuver with your triple movement and say like a quick turn at the end if you're fast cav, it's not game breaking per se. It's very good at getting a flank off, but it's something your opponent can telegraph without it feels bad if it's like on paper that this is exactly how it works, right? So
Danny, tell us about Ethereal.
I got to do it with Swordmasters the other week and it felt real good.
Yeah, I'm sure it did.
Make me sick. Anyway, tell us about Ethereal, mate.
So speaking of Swordmasters, their favorite rule, Ethereal. Ethereal creatures treat all terrain as open ground for the purposes of movement. They cannot end their movement inside impassable terrain, although they can pass through it. In addition, ethereal creatures can only be wounded by magic attacks. Characters that are not ethereal cannot join units that are, and vice versa.
Bah. Very good rule. Amazing rule. All right. But pretty much enough said. All right, moving on to our next couple of pages, which should be a little bit quicker. Evasive. Once per turn, when this unit is declared as the target of an enemy shooting phase. So a target in the enemy shooting phase, it may choose to fall back in good order and will flee directly away from the enemy units shooting at it. Once this unit has completed this move, the enemy unit may continue with its shooting as declared. So you can get out of range, you can turn it from short range to long range, or you can just decide to break away or whatnot. Evasive seems like a good ability. I quite value it.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I mean, Danny, your armies just have loads of it.
I have a lot of evasive in my armies.
Yeah. What are some other uses for it, apart from what I just reeled off?
Just getting out of line of sight, getting out of charge range. Like, it's just free movement. If when you get shot at, like, especially with the opponent not having the ability to, like, say, oh, no, okay, I won't shoot that unit instead. Like, incredible.
So there is some, I think, was it early days that someone brought up the jank ability that you can't fall back in good order or break more than once, or you can't do any of those moves more than once in a phase. So was this a way to jank not breaking or not having to, you know, fail a test and run further away by having more control over it by just automatically falling back in good order? I can't remember if that was a thing that came up or got squashed, but that was like months ago. Maybe it's a thing, whatever. Anyway. Extra Attacks X, a model with this special rule, has a modifier to its attack characteristic as shown in the brackets after the name of the special rule, shown here as X. If this modifier is determined by the roll of a dice, roll when the model's combat is chosen and during the choose fire and combat subphase. Pretty self-explanatory. This is just denoting that it has extra attacks from some source, usually a mount and or a special ability or an assailment for whatnot. But next two are a little bit to unpack. So Peter, take it away with Fast Cav, and then Danny, I'll get you to do Fear for us.
Okay, sure. Fast Cavalry, This is a special rule that says if you have the fast cavalry special rule and are also open order, you get a free quick turn even if you marched. So quick turn is a maneuver that allows you to pivot 90 degrees at the end of movement. And in the actual description of quick turn, it says you cannot do it if you marched. Fast cavalry get to do that. So yep. It's really good. There is an FAQ for quick turn that states that if you quick turn at the end of a march with fast cavalry, you do have to consider how far each of the models has moved, because it cannot move more than its movement allowance. Given that it's a pivot, it's kind of hard to go over your movement. But it is, I guess, a possibility that you pivot in such a way that you ended up being, you know, 1 inch further away from where you started than normal. So,
fair enough. Now, fear used to be a joke of a special rule. And for the longest time, I forgot my entire army had it with ogres. I was just, no one ever took fear tests. I didn't care. Now it is much changed, much improved. Danny, tell us a story.
So fear basically does three things. The first thing it is, if you have fear, you're immune to fear. However, it's models that have fear are immune to fear. So if you have a character in a unit that causes fear, the unit doesn't itself cause fear at that point. But the character would be immune to fear if the unit had to take like a fear test, the character would be unaffected, is I guess how I read that. And then it does two main defensive things. The first of which is if a unit that wants to declare a charge against your unit that caused fear and they don't have fear, and your unit is also bigger than their unit, i.e. has a larger unit strength, you have to make a leadership test first. If you fail the test, you can't charge. So it's like reverse terror.
Yeah.
The other thing that it does is if you're engaged in combat with an enemy unit and your fear causing unit outnumbers the enemy, they have to take a leadership test at the start of combat. And if they fail, they're -1 to hit in combat. You only ever have to take one fear test per turn.
Nice. It is a much improved ability that I actually quite value. Have you guys found it that it's come up much?
It's come up a couple times for me, usually into Vampire Counts and Tomb Kings.
Yeah.
Because they're the armies that'll have the unit sizes generally. I've been trying to fiddle with a Wood Elf list that uses it a little more a little more than you would expect to try and pull that off. That's really it.
Easy done. All right, Feigned Flight up next. If this unit chooses to flee or fire and flee as a charge reaction, it automatically rallies at the end of its move as described on page 117. It is an extremely frustrating ability, I have found. And that's pretty much giving back what Fast Cav did all of 8th edition, which was absolute nonsense. Absolute judicial nonsense where the rules didn't apply to them. No rules. We don't care. We're doing what we want.
And weirdly, yeah. In this game, most Fast Cavalry also have Feigned Flight.
Who would have thought?
Really?
Flight next.
I found most of them do, but
man, almost none of mine do.
Well,
really, I would have thought yours. All yours were the ones that would, because you play all the elves.
I feel like maybe Glade Riders do. I don't think that they do. Dark Riders do for sure,
or maybe you have to pay for it.
Dark Riders not having it is weird.
Yeah, Dark Riders not having it is very strange feeling when you're playing them on the table and they're running away from stuff. It's like, oh. Well, I guess I've got to take a minute here and chill while my guys rally themselves and get in the fight.
Shit together. Fighting extra rank is exactly what it sounds like. Moving on. Fire and flee, which was just described previously. A unit with the special rule that is also armed with missile weapons may declare that it will fire and flee as a charge reaction, which essentially means you execute a stand and shoot and then you flee, right?
Yes.
Mostly. Yeah.
Except that you flee less.
I'll tell you what, I've never read that rule. I didn't need to. I just guessed and it was correct. But when making the flee roll, rolls 2d6 and discards the lowest result. If both results are the same, discard either. So exactly what you said, Peter. Yeah. All right. First charge, Peter, take it away.
Yeah. So if this unit's first charge is successful, the charge target is disrupted until the end of the combat phase.
Fan.
Really great. You see it a lot on like shock. Like knights and stuff. It kind of levels the playing field if someone's playing hoardy, and often is what breaks them. So
yeah. Well, yeah. I see a meta that goes in heavy into horde. That has, okay, well, here your horde. Well, I'm horde, but I have these three dudes with first charge off to the side. And they're gonna hit you in the flank because they're faster than you because you're hordes. And these guys are gonna hit you in the front, and you're disrupted, I'm not, and we're gonna break you.
You know, Adam, there's a lot of like character mounts that have it, or yes, like chariots.
Yep.
And that you can do it pretty cheaply.
Yeah.
It's a great rule. I think it's a great rule. Very necessary. I wish we had that in 8th edition, because just something to break steadfast would have been sweet. Danny, tell us about flaming attacks. And flammable. They're a package. Oh, man.
So this rule doesn't do what you would think it would do.
No, it doesn't at all.
This rule does nothing.
It's never heard of it.
Any attack made or hits caused by a model with a special rule or made with a weapon or spell with a special rule is a quote-unquote flaming attack. In addition, a model with a special rule causes fear in models whose troop type is war beasts or swarms. Unless otherwise stated, a model with a special rule makes flaming attacks in both shooting and combat, although any spells cast by a model are unaffected, as are any attacks made by magic weapons they may be wielding. So flammable, well, and we'll unpack this all in a second because these are so... Anyway, a model that has the special rule cannot make a regen save against a wound that is caused by a flaming attack. So flaming attacks don't naturally ignore regeneration. They only ignore regeneration if the target is also flammable.
Which is a huge condition on this.
Yeah.
And just going to say right now, no one's going to remember that your flaming attacks cause fear in war beasts and swarms. No one's going to remember. Just if you do, congratulations, you're a nerd, but good for you.
I do wish that they gave you, they had the old rule where like if you were inside terrain, you got to reroll to wound rolls. I thought that was
great. Cool. Yes. Yeah. Is flaming dead as a mechanic? Because it just seems not worth it. Peter, is it absolutely just not worth it?
It's not something you pay for anymore. Like it's that you kind of have. That's it.
Yeah, that is it. And that's it for us talking about USRs. We do have, five more spreads of to go.
We'll cover them another day.
Exactly. Not right. Today. We will take them in snack-sized pieces for your auditory pleasure. Delicious. We are going to jump over to mission structure and talking about the missions of the old world. So I would love to say that I'm excited about the missions. I'd love to say whatever. I'm not going to. I'm just going to ask you guys, what do you guys think? Because, they're a bit uninspiring.
I mean, they're just the old missions with like some slight tweaks to make them less annoying.
I do like the changes to Watchtower.
I do too.
Yeah, I thought that was probably the best change that they made. Although I still don't like, is meeting engagement the one you have to roll for the guys before you deploy them?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's better than it used to be, but it's still annoying.
Yeah, I found it's such a problem in the past, meeting engagement, where someone would have their entire army, the other person would have 2/3 of their army, and their guy's like, oh, I guess I'm on the line and pushing because I'm just going to get you before your other models become relevant.
Yeah.
But in general, this plays pretty much the way fantasy's kind of always played, in the fact that you are playing the only real thing that really changes is the deployment map is the thing that changes the most. Mission by mission, you'll either be deploying in a hammer and anvil style or a dawn of war, as in like, you know, facing across from each other, certain amount of inches in, or pull the long edge or the short edge or the diagonal, whatever. But we are exclusively trying to kill each other to get victory points off how much your opponent's unit was worth that you killed, ran down, or the banners or generals, whatever. That is the sole way to decide who has won and lost a game. Is that correct?
Yeah, you just
pretty much
you kill your opponent, and then there's some bonuses in a couple of the missions if you killed them slightly differently than in other missions.
Yep. How do we feel about
in the middle?
Yeah.
Yeah. So missions have changed a lot in various other games the world over. Mission structure has become one of the things that people have been doing to keep tabletop games vibrant and fun and engaging. This, in all honesty, feels like a step, even though the old world is called the old world and is literally stepping back in time, this feels like a step like into an archaic time of when things were, it's a very simple world, But one that is one of my least favorite bits about the Old World. I find the missions kind of dull. Like, I've played 100,000 versions of these exact same missions and they haven't changed at all. How do you guys feel about it?
Yeah, I feel the same.
I feel mixed about it. So what I don't want them to do with fantasy is to make it too much like 40K, in that there are ways that you can win without killing your opponent at all. Like,
I agree,
there should be an element of carnage in this game. Like, that's kind of, otherwise it doesn't drive like engagement. So I feel like that could be the main way that you get points in this game. But also I agree that some of like table quarters or something for like behind enemy lines at the end of the game or something like that would all be really cool additions to the game that would be fun. And some of that mission structure would be cool.
Yeah. What were the missions? So the missions I remember playing in the last big tournament I played, every mission had a fortitude to be gained at the end of the game by how much fortitude, who had more fortitude in table quarters. There was also a couple of other ones. I know we had, it wasn't a first blood. It was first kill, as in like getting a kill on turn one, you got bonus points. And having units in your opponent's deployment zone got you bonus points. I remember that being like the three distinct things we had there to generate that. And my general feel on things is we will, although at the early stage of the Old World, I think everyone's just going to be stoked to be playing the game and just enjoying and reveling, you know, pig in shit, kind of happy to be back. But I can see in a couple of months' time us wanting to add some stuff to these. Will these missions get a lot in the rule book, get longevity, or will these just be like, okay, we'll just use these as a template and strap some stuff on top?
Honestly, I think it depends on Games Workshop. You know, I played 8th edition for a very long time, and the vast majority of events that I went to, they just used the book missions. Yep. And the book missions, like, these are the same missions basically, I think, since, what, 5th edition Warhammer Fantasy Battle?
At least I 100% remember playing these in 6th edition. I don't remember.
These were close to 6th edition ones. My big tournament experience was different than that. Almost every event I went to had custom missions.
So I have gone to events that had custom missions, but the majority I found still just stuck to the book for the sake of sticking to the book. Gav Thorpe, I believe it was in 6th edition, did his own custom mission scenario booklet, which was kind of cool. So I saw that a few times. There was Warhammer Raids, which I didn't like a whole lot, but it definitely existed and had its own mission structure.
What can we do, or what should we do? Should people think about doing if people are finding these missions to be, you know, a little bit on the dull side?
Just think about ways to, you know, add an extra, like you call it, fortitude, or, you know, 500 point bump using, or multiple ways of getting bumps, but that force engagement and force people to rethink how they make their lists. Things like behind enemy lines, where you would try to have units in your opponent's deployment zone either each turn or by the end of the game. Some kind of like four quarters scenario or sixth scenario for points, where if you have more points than your opponent in a certain table quarter or table sixth, as the game progresses, you score points more if you are, you know, in your opponent's area versus your own.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of little things you can do. Like, Watchtower exists. You could do like a kind of a triple Watchtower scenario where there's effectively three objectives in the middle that you're playing for instead of just one. There's lots of like little things that don't fully change the way the game's played, but do force some engagement and some better thought that unfortunately dwarf players will hate because it'll mean they have to move.
Yeah, I don't
move to their deployment zone.
Yeah.
Well, there is. Well, then the gyrocopters become a value piece again. That isn't just there. As you know, they have options, and that could be something that they work towards. I mean, I remember people taking three units of 10 liners to play missions in the days, and they ended up being value pieces as well, because it sucked having 20 miners pop up behind you, and just you're like, oh, geez, I have to turn around an actual real unit to go and sort this out, because this unit, they're very frustrating. So stuff like that is still very much an option too. So I think we talked about this in the green room. So my mission structure, if I was just to throw it out there, whatever points level you're playing to, you want to pack in about quarter of your points value in bonus points. As in, like, if you're playing 2,000 points, 500 points of bonus points should, around about there, should be up for grabs via various different metrics. And like I said, some of that can be just killing your opponent's general, which is already worth extra points. So I don't love that one, but that's an easy get if you want. I do like the line breaker one, being your opponent's deployment turn at the end of the game. So you can be getting your ass absolutely handed to you and still grab a bunch of points at the end. Because that's the biggest thing. If you are losing, there's very little way to dig up in the old world. There's very little, and that has been true for rank and flanks for a very long time. Once someone has established supremacy, there's very few things you can do to wrangle it back. Like, once you are down, essentially the game is just going to get worse. A snowball effect. I would like ways and things for people to play out the game for. So a lot of the times, And I got very competitive in the old world, especially towards the end of, the end times and stuff. People would scoop a lot back then. People would be like, okay, my best unit is broken. There's nothing else to play for. I'm out of here. Like, I'm never going to get those points back. There's no way I've just lost, 800, 900 points in one hit. There's no way I'm getting those back. Cool, you won, whatever. I would love there to be things to play for. So there's a reason to play every turn of the game. And continue to invest and go through, and even if you've lost your first two rounds of an event, to butter up and you got good points in your losses is what I want people to try and feel like they're doing. Like, yeah, he had a list that I was just rock paper scissored by, but I got all the bonus points, and you could be absolutely proud of that. And those are the things I want to be able to play for myself, because I kind of suck.
There's a bunch of cool stuff out there, especially from. I don't know. I mean, I remember playing a lot of missions that were pretty fun to play on fantasy, like with these non-combat objectives. I think 500 points is a good value for that. I think that's okay. Holding the middle is worth 250, and then even doing 75 points or something like that for table quarters, or having an objective that you have to kind of like escort up the table with another unit, like get it past the center line. Would be a pretty fun mission, or even having multiple of those, or ones that you have to use one of your spell casts on or something like that to activate a magic thing. Like, some of the stuff that they do in AOS is good too. So there's a bunch of fun stuff I think they could do that, or like you could do with missions to make them a good time for people to play.
Anything else you want to add to this discussion, Petey Baby?
No, I'm just kind of, given that we've already seen like a kind of pseudo mission pack from GW for Warhammer World. Yeah. I'm very curious to see if the rules team is going to put out like a GT or a tournament pack, which we didn't really see in Warhammer Fantasy Battle post fifth or sixth edition. I would love to see it, because they've done them for Age of Sigmar, and they've done them for Warhammer 40K, and it's completely kind of changed how you play the game because of it. So I'd be really interested to see if they're cooking something up themselves.
I would love that. All right, we're going to talk about magic items. We're going to do magic weapons, and we're going to get out of here. So it's pretty straightforward. Magic items work exactly how you think they do. A unit in the unit entry will have a number of points allocated to how many points they have to spend on magic items. And you just go through the magic item sections and you pick the ones you want, write them down on your army list. And then they add what they do and they add what they does. Very important. One of the most granular and fun things about the old world is making your spicy, unique character, the one that is you, or invokes what you want your unit to do on the battlefield. And magic items are one of the best ways to add character, flavor, and interest to these things. Jumping down, you can't give them name characters. That's usually one of the biggest limitations. They all come with their own stuff, for better and or worse. Usually worse. Usually in every other edition of the game, apart from, was it sixth? Special characters were worse than their generic counterparts. You could, for the points, build something cheaper and better with like a generic captain than a named captain of the Empire, etc. That's been generally true, gents?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, sixth edition had Hydra Blade, so that kind of made it very easy to make a combat character that was better than almost every named character. But
End Times did shake this up, where we had a phenomenal amount of named characters in the game that were all busted on various levels.
And there were a handful of others, like in 7th edition, Teclis for High Elves was silly, and a few others. But for the most part, yes, like you kind of wanted to customize your own jank.
Yeah, Teclis is still paying for sins. Like he's there's no amount of years that guy could be, you know, not untakeable, and I would not be happy. Anyway, let's do this. Magic weapons. Okay, a magic weapon cannot be used alongside an additional hand weapon, magical or mundane, to gain an extra attack. A character that wields a magic weapon cannot set it aside to use a mundane equivalent. For example, a character cannot set aside its magical combat weapon to use a mundane great weapon instead, which I find is an interesting distinction. If a character has more than one magic combat weapon, you must choose which they will use and in their combat, as choosing during step 1.1 of the choose fight combat whatever subphase. Unless the weapon itself states otherwise, the weapon chosen first for the first round of combat must be used for the duration of the combat. If a character has more than one magic missile weapon, you must choose which they will use when they are chosen to shoot, et cetera, et cetera. That's all pretty straightforward. Peter, I know you're going to do it, so I'm just letting you do it. I'm gonna grunt. I'm gonna bemoan, but he is gonna. I know he's gonna read the flavor text. The Ogre Blade started off in style.
The Ogre Blade, 65 points. A broad and heavy blade. The Ogre Blade is much like its namesake, an unsubtle weapon.
The Ogre Blade is a close combat weapon with a strength of +2, an AP of -2. It's got armor bane 1. It gives you magical attacks and has the multiple wounds D3 special rule.
So it is a great weapon without fights last, essentially. The strength +2, -2, armor bane 1.
One-handed.
Yes, one-handed. You get magical attacks and you get multi-wounds. And that is a 65-point price point. So that is the, you know, well and truly over half the points you'll have allocated to a Lord level character. Danny, any good, mate?
Yeah, I mean, this turns any character into just an absolute beat stick. D3 multiple wounds is a very powerful special rule. And combined with, you know, a fighting character's more than average strength value, I think that really plays into this as well to boost it up to often strength 6 or strength 7. It's already got good AP. It's got all the things you want in a combat weapon.
Yeah. We're just going to take this in turns. So I'm going to do the next one. Daniel could do after that, and then Peter again, like we did with the magic stuff. Sword of Battle's up next, 60 points. It is a combat weapon. It is strength +1, -1 AP. It is armor bane 1, extra attacks 1, and magical attacks. I find the Sword of Battle a bit underwhelming. I wish it was an extra either armor bane or an extra attack. 60 points for one more attack at strength, you know, usually be strength either 3 to 4 or 4 to 5. At AP 1 is not 60 points of value, in my opinion. I would rather have a great weapon than this with more strength, more AP, and still has the armor bane. The only thing is, if the magical attacks is a thing in your meta, maybe a good pick. That's you, Danny.
Yeah, it's all right. I wish it had better AP. Like,
me too.
Really, that's where I feel like it falls down. AP 1 is like,
I wish everything had better AP.
But paying 60 points for AP 1 ain't it. Yeah. It just ain't it, baby. Yeah.
What am I, Halberd?
Yeah, what am I?
What am I, Halberd?
That's going to be, that. You know that's going to be a bit now. Yeah, that's going to be a bit. Anyway, take it away with the next one, Danny.
The Duelist Blades, 55 points. Fine weapons, forged by the greatest swordsmiths and imbued with potent runes of quickening. The Duelist Blades are a close combat weapon that are strength user, AP -1 with the extra attacks +2 and requires 2 hand special rules as well as magical attacks. Terrible.
I still think it sucks.
It requires 2 hands. I hate it. I only want to use one hand all the time.
I keep one hand for myself, one hand for the Wyvern, and never to the two shall part.
Exactly. This guy gets it.
It's just too many points. Both of the previous ones, Sword of Battle and Duelist Blades, I would be looking at the 35 to 40, 45 point range for them. They're just like 10 to 15 points too much for me on both fronts. And why are you doing this to me, Danny? Why are you reading the flavor text? You're better than this.
I never was.
Dragon Slaying Sword is up next, 50 points.
He's skipping me on purpose.
I know Dragon Slayer World has like flavor the best text.
One here. Yeah,
I'm giving you flavor. I'm giving you Headsman's Axe. Don't complain. It is combat. It is strength user. No AP. Magical attacks and Monster Slayer. What does Monster Slayer do again? Is that the plus the wound?
Monster Slayer kills monsters.
It's like heroic killing blow, but only for monsters.
Yeah. 50 points for the privilege.
Worth it.
Is it any good? Yeah, is it? Is there enough monsters to warrant this?
If you have a better monster slayer, sure. But if you don't, take it.
Nice.
Like, because, and you know, maybe this won't play out, but from like my experience so far in the games that I've watched, like there are a handful of monsters that are really hard to deal with. So if you don't have a way to deal with them, this is your way to deal with them. And sure, it sucks that it doesn't have any AP. So you're going to want to put it on somebody that can do other shit, basically, or that's so cheap that this is all he's meant to do. And so it doesn't hurt that you're wasting the extra 50 points or whatever in the hopes your opponent's got a monster involved.
The sucks thing about this is I would love to be able to take this and buy them a great weapon and choose to use whichever one I wanted to, but I can't. I've got a magical weapon now. I have to use this and can't switch to a mundane weapon.
Just buy two magical weapons.
Yeah. Easy, simple. Easy. Simple, mate.
Easy.
No problems. Anyway, Headsman's Act. Let's do it. Go for it.
Are you letting me? Oh, you gave me the one with like the least amount of flavor text on purpose. I get how this is.
You do. You are spot on.
The Headsman's Axe. It's 45 points. A wide-bladed axe steeped in the blood of its countless, helpless victims. The Headsman's Axe.
Of all the ones you could choose for the Headsman's Axe, you chose Sultry.
Because there's like six people out there that just had a shiver run down their spine because they're like,
no, they
this
didn't.
Guy is a serial killer. So the Headsman's Axe has a strength plus one. It's an AP of minus one. It's got killing blow, magical attacks, and it requires two hands.
The wrong amount of hands.
Requires two hands.
What's the line? What's the line, Danny?
Actually, okay, hold on. I'm here for the Headsman's Axe.
I am actually okay with the Headsman's Axe, even though it requires two hands, because Killing Blow is just so much better than it used to be.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not Strikes Last.
Mm-hmm. And it's not Strikes Last, yes.
That's
so for those at home who didn't play previous editions, Killing Blow, as a special rule, used to only work on infantry models. Or if you could target out a character on that was riding something. Now it works on anything with the infantry or cavalry troop type, not the subtype either, just like the straight up. So you can kill monstrous infantry, monstrous cavalry. Yep. You can kill all sorts of stuff with this by rolling a six to wound. Just murder for days.
I do rate it. And mostly because of what Danny said, the no fights last on is makes it actually appealing. Because if it had killing blow but was fights last, you're like, well, that guy is dying immediately before he gets to swing. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he will just swing first on the, especially on the charge, is really enticing. I actually think there's a bit of play for the Headsman's Axe. All right.
Like, this is great for characters that can get a 2+ without having to take a shield.
Yeah. Correct. That too. That's a huge deal. Danny, you're up next.
Okay. Wait a minute.
Spell Eater.
Oh, we're on Spell Eater Axe. Oh, one of my personal favorites. The Spell Eater Axe. Funny. No, I don't have a story about this one.
Funny story.
Forged of rune encrusted brass, the Spell Eater Axe is anathema to the winds of magic. The Spell Eater Axe costs 35 points. It's a close combat weapon that's strength user, AP minus one, and has the magical attacks and magic resistance to special rolls. The Spell Eater Axe can eat my axe. I think it's not a good weapon.
Yeah. I actually have found magic resistance easier to come by than I thought, I think. Like on a key unit that has like two multiple characters in it, like it's not hard if you want to get magic resistance to get it in ways that don't involve you giving up your weapon slot. So yeah, that's my general thought.
Yeah, I think this only becomes useful if like someone finds the scariest build is like 18 magic missiles.
Yes.
Then sure, take this.
Yeah, absolutely. Giant Blades up next, 30 points. It is combat strength plus one, no AP. Armor Bane 2, magical attacks, multi wounds 2. So this, I feel like this is a bit of a meta pick. If you're playing in a meta that does not have a huge amount of, you know, 2+save, 3+save, you know, cav and monsters and stuff like that. This becomes a lot better. But the funny thing is that if you're playing that, you're usually not playing in a multi-wound meta. So you're going to want to, you know, looking at things like trolls, essentially, is like the thing I'm thinking about where this is relatively good, where the armor bane doesn't matter that much, but the strength plus one is okay, but the multi-wounds is chef's kiss. For 30 points, it's not breaking the bank either. So I'm not too, I'm either way on the Ogre Blade. I can see it being good.
Yeah, it's 30 points, I think, is the key thing.
Yeah.
So it's not super duper expensive. And multi-wounds too, you know, most secondary hero level characters are two wound models. And if you roll that at six, AP2 isn't terrible by any means.
But dude, so the thing I did when I saw this was I looked straight back at the Ogre Blade. So for 35 more points, so double points plus five. You have strength plus two instead of plus one. You have two AP, sure, but you have one better armor bane than it. And multiple wounds D3, I would rather two multi-wounds two than multi-wounds D3 in general. They both have magical attacks. And I think if you just had one freaking rend on the giant blade, it would be insanely good compared to the Ogre Blade. But just in that exclusive vacuum comparison. Are you the same? I would rather multi-wounds 2 than multi-wounds D3, personally. I just find it, I would rather have bankable damage than I got 3 wounds through on a 4-wound model and I rolled, it would be dead if it was the Giant Blade, and the Ogre Blade could still roll 3 ones.
Yeah.
I like it in a couple of scenarios that maybe we didn't talk about. I really like this on a flying character that's like a wizard hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because like you just have to get one wound through to kill the wizard. Like, mm-hmm. Which is pretty great. Also, I like it on a character that can like fight monsters or be tough against monsters, like a guy on another monster, for instance, because typically you're going to be like trying to roll fives or sixes to wound. So like half the time you're AP2 anyway, and it's multi-damage. So, and it's a cheap weapon, so it can fit with like a lot of defensive gear. So I like it for that stuff too.
Yeah. So I've been running Giant Blade and Piranha Blade kind of intermixed on my Skink Priest on a, or not Skink Priest, Skink Chief on a Ripperdactyl for this very reason. Because he basically flies down and tries to kill wizards and anybody that's just like, I wanted to buy a BSB, but I didn't want to pay for the defense, right? Like that's his whole job, is to just swing in, get one attack through because he's going to be initiative 9 on the charge and kill a character that is more important to my opponent than it is to me. So
Perfectly said. And of course you're playing in a Plague of Rust, a Curse of Rust, whatever it is, spell archetype
generally.
And so a lack of AP is just, who cares? It's essentially everything's AP2 on demand. So that's kind of really spicy. All right, Peter, your turn.
The Sword of Swiftness, 25 points, crafted from magically attuned materials, is sorceled to strike as if with a life of its own. The Sword of Swiftness is strength user. It's got magical attacks. It's got no AP, and it strikes first. It's always strike first. That's it.
That's it. It's kind of trash, right?
Yeah, it's okay. It's strikes first is nice, especially if you're, I often look at this when I'm like, I have 25 points that I can't figure out what to do. Maybe I put this on a champion in one of my units.
Yep.
Just as like, I've been challenged. Fine. Maybe I'll kill you. Right.
Yeah. Or maybe I'll get lucky.
Or maybe I'll kill those two or three guys I need for my front rank to survive. So
that's true as well. Yeah, that's true. Like I got charged, but here I get to, you know, try and make a dent in your attacks first.
Yeah.
That kind of can be sick. Danny, your turn.
All right. Let's see. The Berserker Blade. Quenched in the blood of Untolan. Untolan.
Well done. Well done.
Untold. That's a D. Fallen enemies. You'd love to see the D. The Berserker Blade eternally hungers for battle. The Berserker Blade is a 20-point magic weapon. It's a close combat weapon that's strength plus one and has the frenzy and magic attack special rules. I think this thing is awesome on some characters. Specifically, I like it on Beastmen characters. I like it on Minotaur characters.
Yeah.
Or a Minotaur champion.
I think it's sick, especially with the state of things right now where frenzy stacks. You just pop in straight to the moon I think this is totally acceptable for 20 points. You're just adding a USR to the unit, right? Because the whole unit gets frenzy if you one unit gets frenzy. Is that right? Still the same?
No, it's just that guy.
Just him. Just him. But like, that's good.
Yeah, the Minotaur characters have a rule that say that if they get frenzy, the whole unit gets frenzy.
Yeah. It works there. But it, like, for everybody else, it doesn't.
Yeah, that's fair. All right.
But strength plus one is nice bonus, right? For 20 points.
Yeah. Yeah. And effectively an extra attack.
Yeah. Yeah, plus one strike, plus one strength, 20 points, totally fine. Because yeah, 10 points each on those two, and magical attacks is the kicker. That's yeah, totally good.
The negative is being easily jabated, but
yeah, good word. Yes, that's the first jabated. It's the first jabated of the old world charm, by the way. If people hadn't noticed, mark it down in on your bingo cards. Sword of Might is up next. It has an asterisk next to it, which I can't remember what the asterisk is for.
It's common. You can take more than one.
Oh, that's right. We haven't covered common magic items. Peter, what the hell does common mean?
Any magic item in your army list or in the core book that has little asterisks beside it is an item that can be taken multiple times in your army list. It breaks the unique magic item rule. So you can have multiple guys with Swords of Might or whatever, Phoenix Gems or Trollhide Trousers, whatever happens to tickle your fancy.
And it does indeed tickle my fancy, for it is strength plus one, negative one AP, magical attacks. Once again, 20 points for plus one strength, plus one and negative one AP, magical attacks. Totally an acceptable purchase, especially as this is another one of those ones that I don't mind putting on a sergeant. The next one is one of my favorite ones to put on a sergeant, though. And I'm going to take it as well, because there's two left, and that means there's one each for you two lovely lads. The Biting Freaking Blade is like an ogre's wet dream. It is strength user. Who cares? I am a man eater and I'm strength 5 already. It's AP 2, Unbane 1, magical attacks. So 15 points, AP 2, add initiative, you know, strength 5 attacks. Totally amazing. I am a big fan of the Biting Blade.
Yeah, it's great for 15 points. The AP is awesome.
Yeah, so good. And it still has armor bane. So AP 3 on 6s with like the whatever amount of attacks. Really, really, really good. I think the Biting Blade is fantastic. But only if you have a decent starting strength. If you're strength 3, probably leave it at home. Go Sword of Might.
I love it on like Scarvets and things that are strength 5 or whatever base. So,
Danny, you get the Sword of Striking. Peter, you get the Burning Blade.
The Sword of Striking is a 15-point close combat magic weapon that's strength user, no AP, magic attack special rules, and gives you a plus one modifier to hit. Just a nice way to assure some combat resolution. Again, this is a good item if you're strength 5 and you have like a medium to high weapon skill, but not like a super high weapon skill. Just always hitting on 2s against stuff is nice.
Mm, I agree. It's just a flat percentile modifier. It's actually very rare to just be like, bang, you're hitting better, or bang, you're wounding better in this game.
Right.
The pluses to the dice roll are actually pretty significant and very hard to come by. Peter, it's your turn.
The Burning Blade, 5 points. Once unsheathed, the cutting edge of the Burning Blade writhes endlessly with a living flame. Burning Blade, strength user, AP nil, flaming attacks and magical attacks. 5 points. This is great in a world where everyone's running war beasts and swarms. Or like when the Wood Elf book comes out and they've got some like wild treekin based detachment. Mm. And then you're going to be like, man, I am only taking Burning Blades for the rest of my life.
That's fair. It is also a common as well. So you can spam this if you would like.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, like you said, if there are just tons of swarms and war beasts out there, you're like, well, I can just slap fear for 5 points on any unit on demand pretty easily. Which I kind of like the idea of, but we'll see. It's a very specific meta. That is all the magic weapons, gentlemen. That's all of them. Which is the value pick? I mean, actually, we're going to leave that because we'll get some questions over in part 2 about where the value is in some of these, and we're going to leave that over there. But we gave you our impressions as we went through them, and hopefully you guys have enjoyed this episode of Old World Charm. Gentlemen, any parting notions, anything you want to, any pearls of wisdom to weigh upon people, burden them with even?
I just want to say thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to Goonhammer.com for, you know, helping sponsor us a little bit. I'm sure someday I'll get a jersey with my name on it if I feel free to do so. And thank you to you guys for letting me talk about a game I love.
Yeah. It's a good time. Danny, say some dumb shit.
No.
Yeah.
Dickie, right. Bleep that out. We don't say poop words on the show.
Yeah, sorry. Really? Sorry. Dickie, make sure that gets cut, okay?
Yeah, cut that.
I've sworn twice out of twice before and you guys haven't noticed. I was testing waters actually.
Well, I'm gonna have to put the check mark in the box for explicit content going forward, and then we might as well start an OnlyFans at this rate.
I mean, I'm down. I'm down.
You talked about that from the start. In fact, that's the only reason I agreed to do this.
Yeah, that's literally the buy-in, right? We're going to start a podcast, get big enough that the OnlyFans can pop off.
Yeah,
it's true. It's every content creator's wet dream.
A lot of other people too, apparently.
And a lot of other people.
Blessed be the OnlyFans enjoyer. And on that note, we are out of here. Come over and enjoy some part two goodness over on Patreon and be a Patreon enjoyer. And we'll see you there. Say the thing, mate.
You've been listening to That Old World Charm with those charming chaps, Adam, Danny, and Peter the Falcon. Thanks ever so much. Terrio.